Good afternoon. Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 2nd. I'm Dagna, and I'll be reading the local news for you today. We'll begin with the mini editorial, which was written today by Rolene Beauvais of Sioux City. And Rolene writes, "Let's decrease the politically partisan negativity during this pandemic and improve our mental health by focusing on the four R's: relationships, routine, relaxation, and reflection." And again, this was submitted by Rolene Beauvais of Sioux City. Our first front page story is headlined, 13 Arrested in Sioux City, and this story is written by Brett Hayworth of the Sioux City Journal. Police arrested 13 people in downtown Sioux City early Monday morning after a protest over the death of George Floyd turned violent, with some demonstrators hurling rocks at officers. Five police officers received minor injuries when they were struck with rocks and assaulted by protesters during their arrest. Numerous patrol cars were also damaged by members of the crowd, SCPD Sergeant Jeremy McClure said in a release. After the protest moved past 10 hours over the latter part of Sunday and into early Monday morning, police shot styrofoam canisters of powdered version of pepper spray to disperse the people. Several people refused that dispersal order, and officers moved in to disperse them. During their attempts to disperse the crowd, rocks were thrown at officers, striking several officers. Officers were forced to use some OC powder and spray to continue dispersing the violent crowd, McClure said. Those canisters broke open to release the spray upon hitting the ground. The incident and other protests that turned violent across the country prompted the Sioux City Council on Monday night to grant Mayor Bob Scott the authority to order a citywide mandatory curfew this week if necessary. Scott said a curfew wouldn't go into effect without a really strong recommendation from the police department. Under a curfew, people would not be arrested for going to and from work or during medical emergencies. There's ways to express yourself without damaging property, Scott said at Monday's council meeting. I just ask for calm in our community at the present time. City Manager Bob Padmore noted the public would receive a two-hour notice before our curfew would go into effect. Padmore said, "We just want this tool available should it be needed. We are not calling a curfew at this time." The 13 individuals arrested early Monday were charged with criminal mischief, assault on a police officer, eluding a police officer, and failing to disperse. Of the 13 people arrested, 12 were from Sioux City and one was from Lawton. A dozen of the people arrested were aged 28 or younger. Much of Sunday evening, several hundred protesters gathered around the police and fire headquarters and City Hall at 6th and Douglas to draw attention to police brutality following Floyd's death in Minneapolis. Bystander video captured Floyd, a black man, saying, "I can't breathe," while handcuffed and pinned at the neck, May 25th, under the knee of former officer Derek Chauvin, who is white. Chauvin was arrested Friday and charged with third-degree murder and manslaughter in the death. There have been mass protests around the nation, with many turning violent. McClure said the protest in downtown Sioux City began about 5 p.m. Sunday in front of the police department, and that eventually the crowd size grew to an estimated 400. While the protest started out relatively peaceful, activity escalated as the night went on. At one point, protesters lined up in the middle of 6th Street near Security National Bank, held up signs, and chanted. Police blocked traffic so no one could hit them. Later, the protesters filled the public library parking lot and started yelling in the faces of officers who were deployed to maintain peace. The officers did not respond to their words, but some protesters did. One shouted down others, saying, "This is supposed to be a peaceful protest," and wouldn't move away until the louder ones stopped. Earlier in the evening, the group marched around the police station, stood at the gates of the parking lot, and again started chanting several phrases that were repeated throughout the night. Drivers honked their horns in support of the protesters and shot video with their cell phones. McClure said the protests continued past midnight, and a handful of people tried to instigate more violent demonstrations. Several times, other members of the protest worked to keep things peaceful. Officers throughout the evening took steps to de-escalate any conflict by removing themselves from areas the protesters were at. McClure said the crowd became more aggressive after midnight, and police ordered people to disperse at 3 a.m. When their attempts failed to provoke a reaction from officers, people began throwing rocks and other objects at officers and patrol cars. Rocks were also thrown at the police station, causing damage to a window, he said. At that point, the protest had gone on for roughly 10 hours, and McClure said the crowd was deemed an unlawful assembly, and that's when the arrests began. There had been another rally in downtown Sioux City on Friday, shortly after Chauvin had been arrested. That group of people, who did not turn aggressive, walked several blocks in downtown Sioux City mid-afternoon chanting, "I can't breathe, justice for George Floyd and Black Lives Matter." Ahead of the Friday rally, McClure said department officials presumed the rally would be peaceful, so officers planned not to show force that could be considered provocative. Councilman Alex Waters thanked protesters who marched Friday, as well as officers, for being supportive of those protesters. "I would just ask that protesters remain peaceful and amplify their message to truly achieve change," he said. Our next front page story is headlined, "Hard Rock Sioux City reopens Tuesday as industry looks to recover from millions in lost revenues." And this story is written by Dave Driesen of the Sioux City Journal. The Hard Rock Sioux City Casino resumes taking bets Tuesday after a state-imposed 11-week shutdown that cost the downtown venue millions of dollars in lost revenue. Governor Kim Reynolds ordered casinos and many other businesses to close March 17 to prevent the spread of the novel coronavirus. Last week, the governor gave casinos the green light to reopen as early as Monday with social distancing practices and some other restrictions. Grand Falls Casino and Golf Resort in rural Lyon County was among over a dozen Iowa casinos to welcome back patrons on Monday. At the Hard Rock, the doors were scheduled to reopen at 9 a.m. Tuesday. Due to a phased opening approach, patrons can make bets at slot machines, but table games will remain closed until a later date. The temporary shutdown was a major blow to the casino owners, employees, state and local governments, and local charities. From mid-March 2019 through May 2019, roughly the same 10-week period that the Hard Rock was shuttered this spring, the casino posted adjusted gross revenues of nearly $17 million, according to Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission data. Missouri River Historical Development, the nonprofit group that holds the casino state license, shared in 4.25% of the revenues, or approximately $700,000. MERD distributes its funds to a range of charitable groups, civic organizations, local governments that serve Woodbury County. In the mid-March through May period in 2019, state and local governments, which included the city of Sioux City and Woodbury County, shared in about $5.5 million in taxes from the Hard Rock. Statewide, the 19 casinos took in about $130 million in adjusted gross revenues and paid about $29 million in taxes to state and local governments. Last spring's comparisons do not take into consideration the new sports books that opened in Iowa casinos in late summer and early fall. Hard Rock Sportsbook debuted in September. In some other states where casinos reopened after the COVID-19 threat eased, there was a slight uptick in revenues compared to the same period last year. The IRGC has not put together a forecast for the remainder of the fiscal year, Administrator Brian Orholecki said, but operators and others in the industry are bracing for a potential year-over slowdown, he said. After the initial excitement is over, most people in the industry are expecting a decline. Like other casinos, the Hard Rock will initially operate at reduced capacity as well as adopt social distancing practices and sanitation measures. Entrances are limited to the main and east door during most operating hours. The north entrance, located near Main and Abbey, is open only during the restaurant hours. The new casino hours are 7 a.m. to 3 a.m. on weekdays. On weekends, the casino will offer its normal around-the-clock hours, running from 7 a.m. Friday to 3 a.m. Monday. The casino will also be open 24 hours on select weekends. Temperature screening stations will be positioned at all entry points to ensure no one with an elevated temperature of 100.4 degrees or above enters a casino. All Hard Rock employees who work in direct guest service areas will wear masks as part of their uniforms, and patrons are encouraged to wear masks as well. While the entertainment venue was closed, the Hard Rock laid off its nearly 500 employees. The company said it will bring back staff in phases, and as it continues to reopen the property to full operation under the guidance of state and gaming officials. The Hard Rock's 54-room hotel, the World Tour Buffet, Valet and Cold Check will remain closed for the time being. Our third story on the front page today is headlined, Primary is Today in Iowa and South Dakota. The primary election will play out Tuesday in Woodbury County in a fashion unlike any in history, as the coronavirus pandemic has reduced polling places to 5 precincts amid heavy mail-in voting, and in the aftermath of a protest that turned violent. Only election officials will be allowed in the courthouse as final ballots are counted in the evening. That second step is being taken out of precaution because the Woodbury County Courthouse is only one block from the Sioux City Police Department headquarters, where a 10-hour protest that turned violent stretched into Monday morning, County Auditor Pat Gill said. To ensure the security of election workers, Gill said only those working on the ballot counting will be allowed inside. In a break from long tradition, no candidates or media members will be allowed inside. The primary election polls will be open in Iowa from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. and from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. in South Dakota. In Iowa, since the primary election is used to settle nominations for the Republican and Democratic parties, people who are registered independents cannot take part in the voting. The Woodbury County polling places are Riverside Elementary School at 2303 Riverside Boulevard in Sioux City for precincts 1 through 11. For precincts 12 to 21, the polling place is Long Lines Family Rec Center at 401 Gordon Drive. For precincts 22 to 32, polling places at Sergeant Bluff Luton High School at 708 Warrior Road in Sergeant Bluff. For the precincts 33 to 37, the polling place is Mobile Community Center at 815 East Main in Mobile. And for precincts 38 to 44, the polling place is at the Odo City Hall Community Room, 27 Washington Street in Odo. There has been a huge early mail-in voting, and Gill has said the largest number of absentee ballots ever have already been cast in a county primary. In Northwest Iowa, a hugely watched race will be the Republican primary for the 4th Congressional District. That's where U.S. Representative Steve King, a 9-term incumbent from Chiron, is seeking to hold off well-financed state Senator Randy Feenster of Hull, plus Jeremy Taylor, a former state legislator from Sioux City, Brett Richards, a businessman and former mayor of Irwin, and Steve Reeder, a real estate developer from Arnold's Park. Internal polls have shown a tight race between King and Feenstra. Other key primary contests include 4 Democrats seeking the nomination for a U.S. Senate post to be determined in November, plus nominees for 2 Iowa legislative positions and the Woodbury County Sheriff post. Current Sheriff Dave Drew is not seeking re-election, and the 2 Republican candidates are Todd Wick and Chad Sheehan. For the Iowa House District 11 position, the 2 Democratic candidates are Sarah Huddleston and James Ellison, who both live in Storm Lake. An even bigger field of Republicans want the House District 3 seat, where incumbent Dan Huseman, Republican from Orillia, the longest-serving Republican House member, is not seeking re-election. The Republicans running are Dennis Bush of Cleghorn, Lynn Evans of Orillia, and Mark McHugh of Sheldon. Seeking the right to challenge incumbent Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst in the fall, the Democratic opponents are Michael Franken, Teresa Greenfield, Eddie Morrow, and Kimberly Graham. In South Dakota, the 3 competitive primary South Dakota legislature races on the ballot involve Republican candidates in House Districts 16 and 17, along with Senate Districts 17. The top 2 vote-getters in the House races and the winner in the Senate contest will claim their party's nomination and advance to the November general election. In Senate District 17, incumbent Arthur Rush of Vermilion is aiming to hold off the challenge of another current Republican officeholder, State Representative Nancy Rasmussen of Hurley, and is seeking to move from the House to the Senate. In House District 16, incumbents Representatives David Anderson, Republican of Hudson, and Kevin Jensen, Republican of Canton, are opposed by Bill Shorma of Dakota Dunes, a former state senator who was term limited in that chamber. In House District 17, the four Republicans who are looking to seize two spots are Sidney Davis of Burbank, Charles Clute of Vyburg, Richard Vasgard of Centerville, and Dan Werner of Dalton. Our next story is about the Sioux City Council meeting from Monday evening, and this story was written by Dolly Butts of the Sioux City Journal. And the headline is, Sioux City Council votes to delete Woodbury County Jail Project Resolution from agenda. The Sioux City Council, in a split decision, voted Monday to delete a resolution from its agenda to enter into a 28E agreement with Woodbury County for the installation of public improvements near the Futures Jail. The county plans to construct a 100,000 square foot facility to hold up to 450 inmates. The $50 million facility will be built on a 38-acre plot of land in the vicinity near 28th Street, just north of Lake Forest Mobile Home Community. The aging jail downtown will eventually be shuttered. Under the 28E agreement, the city would financially contribute a maximum of $2.8 million to assist with the installation of a public water main, public sanitary sewer main, public stormwater improvements, and paving of 28th Street for the new jail. Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott said the city needs some resolution from the county on other outstanding issues before moving forward with the agreement. He said the county promised the city the downtown land that the existing jail sits on. Scott said the city will accept the land as long as it's a clean site at the end of the day. But he said the land hasn't been included in any of the agreements between city and the county. It bothers me that they do away with things like collecting our parking tickets and they don't bother to tell us. We have to read about it on an agenda item, he said. That was my fear, that we would get into this jail thing and everything would be great as long as they got what they wanted. This is not the way you have the spirit of cooperation at the government levels. Councilman Alex Waters said the council would bring the resolution back for a vote when the county comes to the table about the issues Scott cited. Waters said, I agree with the mayor wholeheartedly. I think we need to talk about other items and make sure that they're at the table and willing to work with us on those things before we go forward with a $2.8 million of taxpayer money. Councilwoman Julie Shaner said an agreement between the city and the county needs to be upfront throughout the project and after the project for many years. Mayor Pro Tem Dan Moore, who serves as a commissioner on the Woodbury County Law Enforcement Center Authority, said time is of the essence and that the project needs to keep moving forward. He suggested a vote on the resolution be deferred for 2 weeks. He said, I just would hate to indefinitely postpone this because they really do need to get going with the facility and there's a lot of work to be done. At a minimum, Scott, who noted that 80% of county taxpayers live in Sioux City, said the council needs a letter of understanding from the county on the issues that he raised. Scott said, I want resolution for both parties. I think it's in both of our best interests to negotiate in good faith quickly. The council ultimately voted 3-2 to delete the resolution from its agenda. Moore and Councilman Pete Grecken voted no. Shanehur said, I believe it will be back on the agenda very soon. I'm sure the county will understand the message that we really want to strengthen this relationship. Our next story headline is Iowa COVID-19 numbers trending down. The 7-day averages for new coronavirus-related deaths, hospitalizations, and new admissions all continued downward trends Monday, according to state public health. Just 4 new COVID-19-related deaths were confirmed by the state Monday morning, the third consecutive day with single-digit new deaths. That brought the 7-day average, a data point used by experts to provide a broader view of the virus impact, to its lowest in nearly 2 weeks. The 7-day average is for Iowans hospitalized, 368, and daily new admissions, 29.1, also continued downward trends with the latest data published Monday. Confirmed cases continued to climb in Buena Vista County, site of the latest outbreak at an Iowa packing plant, Tyson Foods pork processing facility in Storm Lake. The state confirmed 56 new cases there on Monday. The numbers warrant monitoring over the coming weeks for myriad factors that have been potential to cause increases. Governor Kim Reynolds recently loosened mitigation restrictions, allowing most businesses statewide to reopen while practicing some social distancing measures. Increased social activity over Memorial Day weekend, and this past weekend, thousands across the state participated in protests over a Minnesota man who died after a police officer kneeled on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Reynolds did not hold a briefing Monday on the state's pandemic response efforts. Late last week, she announced she will no longer give daily updates and will instead conduct briefings twice per week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. The briefings also will move from the State Emergency Operations Center at Camp Dodge in Johnston to a conference room in the Iowa State Capitol. Now moving to the opinion page, and we have two letters to the editor today. The first letter is written by Mari Raw of South Sioux City, Nebraska. And Mari writes, Saturday's mini editorial writer stated the greatest number of Wuhan coronavirus deaths were in the U.S. Very misleading. The U.S. had 3 deaths per 10,000 people. Italy had 5.5 deaths per 10,000 people. The U.S. was about half the rate of the rest of Europe. No one knows the total number of deaths in China because the government's failure to accurately report, a common theme for them. Early action by the U.S. reduced our death rate by 50 to 80%. Again, this was written by Mari Rao of South Sioux City, Nebraska. Our next letter to the editor is written by Jerry Eaton of Sioux City, and Jerry writes, Police need to be able to take real pride in their work and to be given the honor they deserve for the difficult jobs they are asked to do day in and day out in our society. I believe good police officers are just as upset and angry as the rest of us as they witnessed, just as we did, how George Floyd died while handcuffed on the ground and outnumbered 4-1 by cowardly and dishonorable police officers, degrading everything our police stand for in our society. The way forward is for police who commit crimes to be rightfully treated as criminals by other police officers who are proud of their careers, their communities, and the people of their communities, no matter the race, gender, or ethnicity, and who want nothing to do with the wrongful killing or harassment of others by police officers in their own police departments or in other police departments in our nation. Police officers are often in tough situations with difficult choices, and they need moral grounding and a steadfast sense of honor for the dignity and value of the lives of others to guide them. When they have this, bad things may still happen. Mistakes can still be made by police just like the rest of us, but blatant negative biases will be held in check, and the real pride of being an officer of the law will be restored along with fair treatment for all of our people. And this, again, this was written by Jerry Eaton of Sioux City. And also on the opinion page, we have today's Tuesday topic, which is written today by Marty Guthmiller and David Stark, who are the respectively the CEOs of Orange City Area Health System and the CEO of Unity Point Health Des Moines. Both serve on the Iowa Hospital Association Board of Directors and Trustees, and their topic is Impact of COVID-19 on Our Hospital. And they write, Rightfully, most attention now is on the frontline care Iowa hospitals are providing for patients stricken with COVID-19. Yet, it's the financial repercussions of this pandemic that may be more threatening to the future of Iowa hospitals. Collectively, Iowa hospitals could lose more than $1.4 billion through September, according to financial modeling by Clifton Larson Allen, a well-known audit and consulting firm. Although Congress has provided stimulus and relief funding, The $550 million that has been received by Iowa hospitals will be on average, the $550 million that has been received by Iowa hospitals will, on average, help support their operations for 45 to 60 days and will not be enough to close the fiscal gap many are facing because of COVID-19. Iowa hospitals, on average, lost half of their gross revenue in the pandemic's first 6 weeks. As a group, it is estimated $12 million net loss per day from mid-March to late April. Much of that is because of the suspension of elective procedures. Although COVID-19 treatment comes at a substantial cost to hospitals, it's been this elective procedure interruption that has caused the most damage to hospitals' financials. For rural Iowa hospitals, it is another blow to an already fragile financial reality. A study conducted more than a year before COVID-19's emergence found 17 Iowa hospitals at high risk for closing. Rural hospitals also rely on outpatient services to provide most of their revenue. Nearly 80% of rural hospital services are outpatient-based, and most elective cases are outpatient procedures. Even with elective procedures resuming, modeling shows it will take more than a year for hospitals to recover from the lost revenue. The growing possibility of rural hospitals in Iowa closing could leave some of the state's most vulnerable citizens in limbo without adequate health care access. The state's major health care systems are not immune to the pandemic's effects either. They have instituted pay cuts, furloughs, and layoffs, adding to an already deep and growing unemployment crisis. Although better prepared now than several weeks ago, Iowa's urban hospitals are seeing higher percentage of COVID-19 patients and will continue negative financial operations for many months as they bring back other essential services and work to preserve capacity for more COVID-19 hospitalizations. A recent economic report released by the Iowa Hospital Association highlights Iowa hospitals' role in supporting the state's vitality by generating more than 143,000 jobs in 2019. They added nearly $7.9 billion to the state's economy. The closure of an Iowa hospital means the loss of access to health care for patients, the loss of an important economic engine for the region, and the loss of an essential driver of a community's quality of life. Proper funding is needed to offset the major financial losses Iowa's hospitals have incurred during this pandemic. When lawmakers reconvene in June, they must move forward with measures and decisions that support the institutions that have been at the front line, Iowa hospitals. Again, this Tuesday topic was written by Marty Guthmiller, who is the CEO of Orange City Area Health System, and David Stark, who is the CEO of Unity Point Health Des Moines. And they are both on the Iowa Hospital Association Board of Directors and Trustees. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 2nd, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now turn to today's obituaries. Our first one, James J. Hartnett, Sr., Dallas, Texas, formerly of Jackson, Nebraska. James J. Hartnett, Sr., 90, patriarch of a large, close-knit Dallas family, formerly of Jackson, Nebraska, died Friday, May 29th, peacefully in his sleep at his home of 52 years. A private rosary was said for Jim on June 1st at the Cistercian Abbey in Irving, Texas. His service will be 9:30 a.m. today, June 2nd, at St. Monica Catholic Church. Jim was born in Sioux City in 1929. He grew up with 10 siblings in Jackson, Nebraska, a very small town near the Missouri River. Faith and family were paramount to him from childhood, and he was especially devoted to his mother, Florence. Jim followed his oldest brother, Bob, to Texas, and many more followed, but he never forgot his Jackson roots. Jim loved traveling back to Jackson throughout his life. At one point, he purchased his childhood home, later transferring it to his brother, Jack, whose family still owns it. He also helped fund a small park across the street from the family home dedicated to mothers. Prior to receiving his BBA and JD from the University of Texas, Jim served during the Korean War in the U.S. Air Force's 5th Communications Squadron Command based in South Korea. His base regularly came under fire from Bed Check Charlies, North Korean attack planes. Jim first met Emily High in passing at the University of North Texas. Later, while attending the University of Texas, he spotted Emily walking by the UT bookstore, ran after her, and invited her for a soda. Emily never dated anyone again, and this simple invitation led to their amazing 64-year marriage. Jim insisted he married up and called Emily my bride until the end. Jim was a prominent trial and probate attorney in Dallas. He began his law practice in 1959 at Turner Atwood White McLean and Francis. By 1967, the firm had changed to Turner Hitchens McNerney Webb and Hartnett. Over the years, Jim became involved in probate litigation cases and was among a handful to develop this specialty in Texas. In 1982, he founded the Hartnett Law Firm, an estate and trust litigation boutique law firm with two of his sons. One of his proudest accomplishments, the firm has grown to include 9 family members spanning 3 generations and is thriving today. Jim always said, "Isn't practicing law fun?" He didn't believe in taking vacations because he loved his work so much, unless it involved family. In 1970, Jim founded Hartnett Farms, an active farming operation in Ellis, Limestone, Navarro, and Hunt counties. His grandfather and great-grandfather were prominent farmers in Nebraska, and he sought to follow in their footsteps. For decades, until the March 2020 COVID stay-at-home orders, his regular routine was to work 6 days a week at his law firm, attend Mass, and travel to his farms on Sundays. He especially loved when his children and grandchildren enjoyed his farms, always adding vehicles, toys, and animals to the operation for their entertainment. As a young teenager, Jim pledged to his parish priest to never drink or smoke. He kept his pledge and never even drank communion wine. A gentleman in every way, he was unfailingly polite and respectful to all. Deeply religious, he regularly carried a rosary in his pocket and was a Knight of the Order of Malta. As a self-made man, he cared nothing for material possessions and for most of his life was happy driving an old station wagon. Despite being successful in every facet of his life, Papa's favorite activity was patiently pushing his many young grandchildren on his backyard swing set and pulling them in a little red wagon. He was the salt of the earth. He often said that being a parent was the greatest gift in life and was so proud of each of his children and grandchildren. Jim had an amazing gift with people, and his counsel was sought by many. He was generous with family, friends, and strangers. He believed strongly in giving generously and consistently to charity and did not want recognition for doing so. Jim believed in the importance of education and worked hard to send his 5 sons to Cisterian Preparatory School and his 2 daughters to Ursuline Academy and the Hockaday School, and all 7 went to college and then graduate school. He supported 6 through law school and 1 through business school. Jim served as president of the St. Bernard Parish CCD in 1964, on the board of trustees of Cisterian Prep School during 1975 to 2005, and on the board of trustees of the Catholic Foundation. He was elected chairman of the Dallas Probate and Trust Law Section in 1974, and he was one of the first attorneys in Dallas to be board certified by the Texas State Bar in estate planning and probate. Jim's family is especially grateful to Donna Spencer, his legal assistant for 53 years before her death last year. Her 2 children, Kevin Spencer, previously a partner at the Hartnett Law Firm, and Tracy Johnson, who currently works at the firm. Bruce Wooten, Jim's go-to person for anything that was needed. Molly McHugh, his physical therapist. Ginger McFartridge, Julie Johnston, and Barbara Whitmire for their devoted assistance to Jim and Emily. Walt Hill, Nebraska. Carmelie Olson Harlan, 53, of Walt Hill, passed away Sunday, May 31st at a hospital in Primgar, Iowa. Carmelie will lay in state at her residence in Walt Hill beginning today. Services will be noon Thursday at the small arena in Macy, Nebraska. Burial will be in the Omaha Tribal Cemetery. Carmelie was born on September 6, 1965, in Pender, Nebraska, the daughter of Gary Olson and D. Carmen Tyndall. She attended schools in Walt Hill and Macy. In 1995, she was united in marriage to Scott Harlan Sr. Carmelie worked several jobs, including nurse's assistant, detention officer, and tribal court clerk. She enjoyed her time at home raising her 9 children. She had numerous friends, liked to hunt, and enjoyed the outdoors and listening to country music. South Sioux City. Janice E. Simonson, 95, died Saturday, May 30th. Burial will be June 13th at Memorial Park Cemetery, Sioux City. Arrangements by Nelson Berger, Northside Chapel. Onawa, Iowa. Kathy Brown, 72, died Sunday, May 31st. Celebration of life will be June 5th at 7 p.m. at the Rush Family Care Service in Onawa. Sioux City. Joanne Stanwyck, 83, died Friday, May 29th. Private graveside service. Arrangements by Waterbury Funeral Service of Sergeant Bluff. Jeffrey Lynn Jeff Nash, 68, a lifelong resident of Sioux City, passed away Friday, May 22nd at a Sioux City hospital, complications due to cancer. Private family graveside service will be in Lincoln Township Cemetery, Plymouth County, Iowa. A memorial service will be at a later date. On December 7, 1951, Jeffrey was the 3rd son born to Alvin C. and Evelyn E.P. Nash. He attended McKinley Elementary, East Junior High School, and East High School, graduating with the class of 1970. Jeff and Loretta Gedwillo were united in marriage at Grace United Methodist Church in Sioux City on May 27, 1972. They were blessed with 2 girls and 2 boys, Amanda, Jacob, Michael, and Sarah. Jeff spent his entire career as a carpenter. Initially, he used his skills building houses. He then became a member of the Carpenters and Joiners Union while working for Van Osdell Plastering and Drywall. Many commercial projects in Sioux City bear his mark. Jeff retired in 2017. Jeff had many interests, including genealogy, fishing, gardening, and watching the Iowa Hawkeye football games. There wasn't anything he couldn't do as a handyman. Jeff served as a Cubmaster for PAC 3 at Crescent Park United Methodist Church, president of Siouxland Youth Athletics, and attended Grace United Methodist Church. Dorothy C. McGinty, 89, of Dakota Dunes, passed away Saturday, May 30th, in South Sioux City due to COVID-19. Memorial services will be at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Moore and Becker Hunt Chapel. Online condolences may be directed to www.meyerbroschapels.com. Dorothy was born on August 7, 1930 in Jackson, Nebraska, to James and Ruth Love. On May 7, 1949, she married Michael McGinty in Elk Point, South Dakota. Michael passed away in September of 2013. Dorothy lived in South Sioux City until 1976 when she moved across the river to Dakota Dunes. Sioux City. Darlene F. Kustert, 83, died Sunday, May 31st. Service will be June 4th at 10:30 a.m. at the Morningside Lutheran Church. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation June 3rd, 6 to 8 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Sioux City. Esther M. McDaniels, 81, died Sunday, May 31st. Service will be June 4th at 10 a.m. at the St. Thomas Orthodox Church. Burial will be at the St. Thomas Orthodox Cemetery, Graceland Park Cemetery. Visitation will be June 3rd, 5 to 7 p.m. at the church. Arrangements by Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Sioux City. Edward Anthony Nelson, 88, died Sunday, May 31st. Service will be June 6th at 10 a.m., Morningside Chapel, Christy Smith Funeral Home. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be June 5th, 5 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home. Sioux City. Heng Seng, 70, died Sunday, May 31st. Services will be June 5th at 1 p.m. at the Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Visitation will be June 5th from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the funeral home. And that concludes the obituaries for today. Our next story is a South Dakota story. National Guard still deployed for violent protests. Sioux Falls. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem on Monday said she is keeping the National Guard deployed and ready to step in if demonstrations over the death of George Floyd turn violent. The Republican governor deployed National Guard troops to the scene of violent protests in Sioux Falls on Sunday night after stores were vandalized and protesters hurled rocks at police. Her comments came shortly after President Donald Trump told governors in a video conference call they look like fools for not deploying more National Guard members to demonstrations across the country. Noem said she would keep the National Guard pre-staged nearby protests planned in other cities across the state. She said rioting and looting will not be tolerated. The governor said there is a stark contrast between the peaceful protest in downtown Sioux Falls and the vandalism that occurred during the night near the city's largest mall. Sioux Falls police are investigating vandalism at several businesses. She said protests have a purpose. That purpose was met yesterday in a peaceful protest that I think for many people honored the memory of George Floyd, but also recognized that we have to take action. Noem said she wanted to work towards solutions against inequality and racial discrimination. Our next story headline is Texas pair sentenced to prison for using stolen credit cards in Sioux City. A Texas man and woman who used stolen credit card numbers to buy goods from stores in Sioux City and other Iowa cities have been sentenced to more than 5 years in federal prison. Chief U.S. District Judge Leonard Strand on Friday sentenced Yunel Sanchez, 36, of Grand Prairie, Texas, and Shannon Marlowe, 35, of Fort Worth, Texas, to 61 months in prison. Both had pleaded guilty in U.S. District Court in Sioux City to conspiracy to transport interstate stolen property, interstate transportation of stolen property, wire fraud, and aggravated identity theft. 11 additional charges of wire fraud and 10 other counts of identity theft were dismissed as part of a plea agreement. Marlowe and Sanchez used stolen credit card numbers to produce credit cards and make purchases totaling at least $24,198 in June at Harbor Freight Tools, Pier 1 Imports, and Shields in Sioux City, and at stores in Clinton, Dubuque, and Mason City, and in Rochester, Minnesota. The two were arrested June 11th after employees at Sioux City Shields stores in Southern Hills Mall noticed the two, who fit a description of a couple traveling across Iowa and Minnesota in a Penske moving van and making suspicious purchases on a credit card. Workers observed a Penske truck parked outside and called police. Police searched the van and found merchandise, including lawnmowers, welders, welding supplies, tools, household goods, and furniture. Also inside were a credit card embossing machine, 15 forged credit cards, 3 laptop computers, and numerous cell phones, flash drives, and receipts for purchases. Okay, our next story headline is Sioux City Man Stabbed Sunday Night. Sioux City police are investigating a late Sunday stabbing in which one man was hurt. Officers were dispatched at 10:21 p.m. to 1700 Jackson Street, where a man reported being stabbed 2 times by an unknown suspect after an altercation. The victim was transported to Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center for non-life-threatening injuries. Anyone with information about the incident is asked to call the Sioux City Police Department at 279-6440 or Crime Stoppers at 258-TIPS. Sioux City police are seeking a suspect who robbed a Sioux City convenience store early Monday. Police said an armed man entered the Brew convenience store at 2501 Floyd Boulevard at 12:09 a.m., demanded cash, then fled on foot. The suspect was described as a black male in his early 20s, approximately 5'10" tall and weighing 160 pounds. He was wearing black pants and a black sweatshirt. Anyone who has information about this crime is asked to contact Crime Stoppers at 712-258-TIPS. Our next story, man accused of sexually abusing juvenile, Storm Lake, Iowa. A Storm Lake man was arrested Friday on charges of repeated sexual assaults on a juvenile. Mario De La Paz, 35, was booked into Buena Vista County Jail on 2 counts each of third-degree sexual abuse and incest, administering harmful substances, and lascivious conduct with a minor. The Storm Lake Police Department said in a news release that it had received a report of the incidents on May 12th and began an investigation with the Buena Vista County Sheriff's Department, Iowa Department of Human Services, Centers Against Abuse and Sexual Assault, Mercy One Child Advocacy Center, and the Buena Vista County Sexual Assault Response Team. According to court documents, Della Paz forcibly had sex with the victim at a lakeside home sometime around December 25th and on more than one occasion from January 1st through April 10th in a bedroom closet in a Storm Lake home. Della Paz forced the victim to sniff a white powder, which impaired the victim, court documents said. And our next story headline is Sioux City to continue to waive late fees. The City of Sioux City announced Monday that it will continue to waive late penalties and fees for utility bills and parking fines through June 30th amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The previous grace period was scheduled to end after Sunday. Residents are encouraged to pay utility bills and parking tickets online, by phone at 279-6132, option 1, or by using the utility billing drop box located on 6th Street on the north side of the library's parking lot. Drop boxes are also available at all Sioux City Hy-Vee stores and the north side fairway. We'll now move to the sports section and the Sioux City Journal columnist Terry Hursom. The headline is Major League Baseball Fighting Over Money. Baseball's 30 major league teams are squabbling with the players over prorated salaries, and the MLB's affiliated minor league teams are looking more and more like their 2020 seasons will not be happening. The COVID-19 pandemic has definitely turned our sports world and the entire planet Earth upside down. However, Americans are slowly starting to emerge from isolation, and there are encouraging signs that this won't be as catastrophic as some have suggested. Granted, I'm sorely lacking on the expertise necessary to give anyone advice on anything relative to these history-making times. So, please don't feel as though I'm disrespecting all who have lost loved ones to one of the more severe health threats any of us has ever seen. My curiosity of late involves the days, weeks, and months to come, and when human beings resume competition in any and all sports, the area in which I've invested a lifetime. Long before this virus came along, a game of baseball was absorbing major wounds to its image and allure, most of them self-inflicted. Los Angeles Times columnist Bill Plaschke offered some highly interesting facts in a column the Journal published on Sunday. If you missed it, Plaschke noted last season's Major League Baseball attendance of 68.5 million as being nearly 12 million less than the grand total from 12 years earlier. Even the game's armchair fans were relatively disinterested in a 7-game World Series watched by the third fewest TV viewers the Fall Classic has drawn in at least 47 years. By the way, the Washington Nationals won the deciding 7th game in a battle with the Houston Astros. I looked it up on the internet just to be sure. Proposals to launch an 81-game season in early July have yet to gain approval from the Major League Players Association, which is digging in its heels over money. That's because the billionaires who own the teams are offering to pay only 25% of the contracted salaries, not 50%, for what amounts to half a normal schedule. When you consider that most, if not all, of these games may be played in empty ballparks, hence no ticket receipts, that's not so difficult to understand. Yes, the players are more and more greedy as time goes by. If they truly love the game, they should bite the bullet and play rather than turning their noses up at a great deal more money than America's millions of jobless people are using to survive. Then again, the owners are the folks who've profited most from Major League Baseball teams from the very beginning. Maybe it falls most on them to come to the rescue of what was once strongly entrenched as America's pastime. In a world starved for entertaining diversions, our independent American Association has also been pointing toward a season that would begin in early July. The league is still hoping to play an 80-game schedule, just 20 less than usual, and extend play a few more weeks into September than usual. Near as I can tell, we'll be getting more news on that subject after the 12 association owners engage in a conference call this Friday. In the meantime, it has been business as usual for Steve Montgomery, who has doubled the Sioux City Explorers postseason appearances from 4 to 8 over the last 5 years. Still hunkered down in suburban Tampa, his off-season home, Montgomery has been putting together another very promising roster. He says, if we can figure out an avenue for us to play, we can get some national exposure. There's an opportunity for us if we're able to play. As of Monday, Montgomery has 24 players under contract, and 17 of those are pitchers. At least 3 of the pitchers won't be reporting, 2 because they're Dominicans who evidently will not be allowed to enter the U.S. The vacancies in the everyday lineup are being left open to possibly insert 4 of the best players Montgomery has had the last few years. Names I'm not at liberty to publish, but names that would quickly turn that lineup into a juggernaut. Monday's new addition was right-handed pitcher Kent Hasler, who has pitched 2 seasons for the Frontier League's Lake Erie Crushers, striking out 133 batters in 105 innings, while posting a 2.4 ERA and 70 appearances, all in relief. Informing Mongol that we're climbing above 90 degrees on Monday, the Ohio native noted the weather he's dealing with in Florida. "I gotta get out of this heat," he exclaimed. "I was teaching baseball academy the other day, and it was 122 degrees in the building. Hope we can help him out." And I have time to read a couple paragraphs from another sports story locally, back on the field, Sioux City. For North baseball coach Nick Tilo, it felt like a normal day in June. He was on the field with his players, hitting fly balls, hitting grounders, observing his players taking cuts in the batting cages during a sunny day. "They picked up where we left off and jumped right in. They were focused mentally, and I think they were ready," Tilo said. "Physically, I think the biggest thing is getting reps in the cage and fielding ground balls and fly balls. It was great to be back. We had a long practice because it's 2 weeks until we play, so we need to get everything together before we go to Council Bluffs Thomas Jefferson in 2 weeks." The fact that Iowa had its first official days of practice in order to prep for the first games on June 15th even made national headlines when it was on ESPN.com's headlines on its main page. And that concludes today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 2nd. I'm Dagna, your reader for today. And you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you very much for listening.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. Flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Xofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once weekly or twice monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. Dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.